I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, where have all the teachers gone? Last week in the New York Times, there was a story titled, Teacher Shortages Spur a Nationwide Hiring Scramble, Credentials Optional. The article stated that all over the country, districts are struggling with shortages of teachers, particularly in math, science, and special education. A growing number of English language learners are entering public schools, but it's hard to find bilingual teachers, so some districts are looking for teachers outside the country. In California, the number of people entering teaching preparation programs dropped by more than 55% from 2008 to 2012. And nationally, the drop has been 30% from 2010 to 2014. School districts in Wisconsin are reporting that at this point in the summer, there are vacancies that have not yet been filled, and school is right around the corner. This hour, we'll have three guests, a longtime teacher of social studies and economics at Arrowhead High School in Heartland. We'll be speaking with the author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession, and the president of the 1.6 million member American Federation of Teachers will also be joining us. We're very interested in hearing from particularly those of you who are teachers. You're probably getting your classrooms ready, or some of you have already started school. Why is it, do you think, that we're seeing a shortage of teachers and a lessening number of young people who want to enter the teaching profession? Tim O'Driscoll has been with us before, taught social studies and economics at Heartland Arrowhead High School for 40 years. He retired in 2010. He coached very successfully the school's baseball team for a number of years. He teaches teachers as director of the Center for Economic Education, UW-Milwaukee. He is also the official, this guy's many talents, the official scorer for the Milwaukee Brewers home games, and he scored his 2,000th game in April of this year. Tim, a pleasure to have you on the air again. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be back on your show again.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. Also joining us this first part of the program is the author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Dana Goldstein is a staff writer at the Marshall Project, a contributor to Slate, The Atlantic, and other magazines. And Dana, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a Wisconsin perspective, and Wisconsin may be unique in some ways, Tim. Why do we have a shortage of teachers in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, certainly Act 10 has had a major impact, Kathleen. And, you know, it seems to me, and again, this is my perspective, that the politicians have certainly demonized the teaching profession. Through the major part of my career, I think teachers were looked at as the pillars of the community and very important people. And suddenly, overnight, when the propaganda machine started, we became greedy, we became lazy. And I think it's an actual outward attack on public education. And I do think that there are some people who would like us to head towards school for profit. And that if you look at fund managers who are managing huge amounts of money, one of the only new businesses that they could get into would that be of schools. And I think it's important to note that, you know, we're not turning out a manufactured product. We're not turning out widgets. We're turning out people. And I think people that who their lifetime passion has been schools and that of educating citizens to develop their life skills, not just for a job, but being a contributing person to a community, have to look at this and really begin to fight back from this attack. And you know, if you have a son who is now a senior at University of Wisconsin Milwaukee, and many people are telling their children, because of this attack, maybe you shouldn't go into education, and that's a very, very sad note.
That's a very sad note. And if you were looking at just entering now, Tim, would you have become the wonderful teacher? Well, you wouldn't. I don't know if you would have gone into teaching, and what
well,
a loss that would have been.
I still think that I would have no matter what, because to me it never was a job; it was a way of life. But it was also wonderful to be respected and to be thought of. You know, I think people forget that every teacher is a college graduate. And if we look at every other profession that requires a college degree, if you add up all of the doctors, the lawyers, and the engineers, they don't come close if you combine the numbers to the number of people who are school teachers in grades K through 12. I think there's almost 3.7 million of us. And, you know, we have to get away from this attack.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you talk to people in your community and when you talk to people all over the state, schools are really the centerpieces of communities in many ways. It's still true that most of our children do go to public schools, and
yes,
we value those schools, and we really value the people who teach our children. Is there some kind of a disconnect between what people are experiencing in their schools and what politicians want to do with schools?
Well, I think that's, you're hitting the nail right on the right on the head there, Kathleen. Because if you talk to individual people, if you come out here and go into the Arrowhead District or the Pewaukee District or Sussex Hamilton, Kettle Moraine, people love their schools.
Right.
They absolutely love them. And then for some reason, the politicians think that they need to go in and to dramatically change things. For example, if people believe in local control, which I do, if the Arrowhead District wants to pass a referendum that allows them to increase taxes to do some new things for the school, I think they should be allowed to do it. But we also have in the state, we have control now that won't let the local schools even allow that referendum, not for building now. I'm not talking about building. I'm talking about to change some of the educational programs. By law, they are not allowed to do that. And when the governor put through Act 10 and said that he's going to now cut the funding to public schools, and it's going to be made up by now having the teachers pay for part of their retirement, which is fine. I've got no problem with that. Or with their retirement fund, I've got no problem with that. The money that's been cut is so drastic that schools really are in very difficult shape because they don't have enough money coming in from the state to pay for mandated programs.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say that you don't mind paying more for that, but what it does is lessen a teacher's salary. And
well, sure it does.
They don't make very much money, really. Teachers just don't.
No. And what's happened now is that we used to have a structure where the number of years that you taught and the amount of education that you had, there was a structure. That's gone now. And teachers can be put in any place as to pay. Now, certainly there is competition to bring new teachers in, but the problem is that there are less people, as you mentioned, entering teaching. And there's something else, Kathleen, also. The retention of teachers. If you look at the number of people teaching now,
mm-hmm,
about half of them are baby boomers. And so that means what? That they're getting close.
They're getting old.
Yeah, they
right?
are.
I know.
And they're getting close to retirement age. And then if you look at the novice teacher, within 5 years, between 40 and 50% of them quit. And so if you think there's a shortage now, look down the road, you know, and the shortage is going to become acute unless we change things.
Mm-hmm. Charlene writes on Facebook, Tim, the severe anti-teacher attitude in Wisconsin and increasingly thankless working conditions drive away potentially quality teachers. In some countries where education is highly valued, so are the teachers. They're treated accordingly. Their training and mentoring are superior. In this country, there's much lip service about what we need to do, but actions do not support those words.
I think I do agree with her very, 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 very strongly. And, you know, I just think that we need to begin to look at the importance of, again, I'm a public education person, of public education, and what it has meant to this country. And I would love to talk to someone and have them stand up to me and look me in the eye and say, we don't want strong public schools. We want terrible public schools. Why would you possibly want that? And except for alter your own special motives, why are you attacking public school teachers like you are?
And when you talked earlier, Tim, about the attacks on public education and what you see as a desire for private schools, voucher schools being expanded in the state of Wisconsin, do you really think, what is the motivation behind that? And do you think that that's going to grow in this state, more voucher schools?
Well, I think it's going to grow dramatically. And the fact is, when you continue to take public school money and put it into the hands of private schools, and if my two daughters, if I had decided, for example, to send them to a private school, or let's say to a parochial school, then I think I have to pay for that myself. I don't think public monies should be going there. Do I think that there should be choice? Yes, but I don't think that it should involve the fact of public monies being put into private schools. And again, remember, in public schools, we take everybody. It doesn't matter what their disabilities are. It doesn't matter what their problems are. We take everybody. Private schools don't have to do that. And the additional cost of taking care of children who've got major disabilities is extremely high, and again, I don't think people realize that.
Mm-hmm. Let's take at least one phone call for you, and then we'll switch our focus to Dana Goldstein, author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattered Profession. Let's go to Mark in Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thanks for doing the show. I mean, we really shouldn't be surprised about the shortage of teachers, given how little respect the profession has. I mean, you can see that after Act 10, a whole slew of teachers retired, and the attitude for many was, well, good, we'll get rid of quote-unquote dead wood, instead of getting rid of really excellent and experienced people. I mean, in any other profession, if a slew of doctors retired, then people would be appalled at that. If you need a surgeon, you wouldn't go to the surgeon just out of med school. You want the person who's done the operation for a decade or so. And so that's one aspect of how little the profession is respected. Another way is the fact that there certainly needs to be reforms, or we need to be looking at it. But teachers are the last people that we ask how to do things. We bring in expert, quote-unquote experts, who may have taught for a year or two and then become... they know how to teach, and they tell people who've been doing it for 30 years how to do it. And then finally, of course, the pay really is an issue. I mean, I teach in UW colleges. Act 10 was an 8% cut to my pay, basically. And I'm able to kind of get by. I freelance, and I'm able to support myself, my colleagues who have a family and children. They're all working second and third jobs because we simply aren't making enough in order to support ourselves. I mean, there are some faculty in Madison who are doing very well, but a lot of us are not. And, I mean, all of that. So the idea that there's a shortage, I mean, of course there's a shortage.
Tim.
Well, you know, and you make some very, very good points here. The fact that I think as a society, we have to look at ourselves. Do we want there to be strong public schools? I can't imagine the vast majority of people not answering that. Of course we do. Well, then we begin to look at that you had your property taxes cut $10 or $12 a year. You can't even buy a fish fry with that. And so for people to be politicians and stand up and say, we're going to cut taxes again and again and again, but at what cost? Public education is the greatest benefit that we have, and the schools in Wisconsin, K-12 through the college level, to even, and I know we're not going to get into this today, but the fact that we are also attacking the UW system, it's insane. Do you know the road that you're going down here? And we need to have reforms now and bring this back to sanity.
Tim, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks. Thank you. I enjoyed it greatly.
Tim O'Driscoll, he taught social studies and economics at Arrowhead High School in Heartland for 40 years, retired in 2010. He teaches teachers, director of the Center for Economic Education at UW-Milwaukee, and is also a big baseball guy. He's the official scorer for the Milwaukee Brewers home games. We're going to continue with Dana Goldstein, author of Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. She's a staff writer at the Marshall Project, a contributor to Slate, The Atlantic, and other magazines. And take more of your many phone calls. They're coming in steadily this hour. So if you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dana Goldstein is with us now. Dana, thank you very much for being with us. Wisconsin, there's a lot going on here in the state of Wisconsin. It was interesting for me to see that the teacher shortage really is a national problem here. It's present in the state of Wisconsin, too. But how incredibly political all of these issues have become when it comes to educating our children. Has it always been so, Dana?
Yes. One of the things I found when researching my book, The Teacher Wars, is that we've been arguing about the role of teachers in our democracy, how much we should pay them, how we should evaluate their work for about 200 years, all the way back to the early 19th century when we first established what was then called our common school system. And interestingly, since we're talking about teacher shortages today, we've been in a constant cycle in American history of thinking we have either too many or too few teachers. I mean, even if you look at the past 15 years since 2000 to now, around the year 2000, there was a lot of worries of a teacher shortage. Then during the recession that we're coming out of, districts cut their budgets and states cut their budgets, and there were too many teachers, too many young people coming out of education colleges who could not find a job. And now we're back again as the economy picks up and private sector hiring picks up to a situation of teacher shortage. So these cycles have been with us for a very, very long time.
And what about the ideas of what to teach and how to measure learning?
Yeah, those are controversial perennially. I mean, we always discuss, are we educating future citizens or future workers? You know, whose influence is most important on the curriculum? Is it CEOs who are looking to staff their companies? Should we be focusing more on civics and what our voters need to know to make educated choices at the ballot box? I mean, these questions, there isn't any one right answer to them, but I think in a democracy there's a healthy tension there. And I think, unfortunately, right now, we don't very often debate so much why we're educating children. We're very much caught up, I think, in more granular but also important debates about standardized testing and
yes,
teacher politics, which, as you know, in Wisconsin have just, you guys have been a locus for these debates.
Mm-hmm. We have. To what do you attribute the nationwide shortage of teachers? It seems to me as though that is very, very problematic.
Yeah, well, so not every place has a shortage. So, for example, I live in New York City, and this is still an extremely competitive market where many people cannot find teaching jobs, even though they'd like to teach. But in those places where there is a shortage, there are a few things at play. First of all, and your previous guest mentioned this, the public schools are dealing with an influx of students who've been diagnosed with special education designation. So this could be kids on the autism spectrum, and they have special needs. They may need a full-time assistant with them. They're in smaller classes. So this causes the need for more teachers. We have an influx of immigrant students who can't speak English. We need teachers that are trained to do that and to work with them. We also have more and more students taking higher-level math and science classes at the high school level, and this is a good thing, but we need teachers who are qualified to teach those subjects. The second set of issues are sort of the macroeconomic ones that I just mentioned. During the recession, there was a lot of budget cuts in states, and so states stopped hiring teachers or even laid teachers off. Now we're coming out of it, and guess what? That was a very short-sighted thing to do, and these are the sorts of reasons why we have a teacher shortage.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that a lot of young people, because I've read this, that the recession has lifted some, the economy is doing better, so young people are thinking, teaching, you know, might be okay, but it sure doesn't pay enough money. I want to go into a profession that pays me more. Is that a factor?
You know, we don't have really good polling or data on what people are thinking as they make their career choices, but certainly that seems to be the case throughout history. that when the economy is less strong, people look more toward public sector jobs, including teaching. And then when the economy rebounds, people are more looking to get into those higher paid fields.
Mm-hmm. And what about this whole movement to not have as much control over what happens in your classroom as you used to, that instead there are so many hours? I've heard so many teachers say we're spending hours and hours making sure that our students do well on the standardized tests in math and in English because, you know, our performance is based on that. Is there too much emphasis on that or not?
Yeah, so we know that of the current teacher corps, there's a great deal of dissatisfaction with the big, big focus on standardized tests, which is absolutely real. It's a nationwide issue. What we don't know, and, you know, this is from my look at the data, the polling, the research, what we don't know is whether young people who are in college or graduate school and making career choices are being influenced by this debate over testing. We don't know if they are avoiding teaching because they have concerns that teaching is no longer an autonomous profession. So while we see a lot of dissatisfaction within the profession about that, we don't know to what extent that's shaping young people's choices about a career.
Has testing been a big part of determining how well students are doing in this country for a long time, or does it come in waves?
It comes in waves, but it's been with us. Those waves have been with us for a long time. I mean, if you go back to the 1850s in Massachusetts, Horace Mann, who's considered the father of our public school system, was, you know, instituting standardized testing at that time, in part because he wanted not only to know how students were doing, but how teachers were doing. There was another big burst of standardized testing in the early 20th century, and that was very influenced by ideas that were coming from business and from factories at the time, the idea that we need to measure teachers and students in very sort of mechanistic ways. And these ideas have always been with us.
Okay. Let's go to phone calls. We have so many of them. Dana Goldstein is our guest now, author of Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. And let's go to Maddie in Waupaca. Thanks for waiting, Maddie. Hi.
Hi. My daughter was a teacher down in Louisville, Kentucky for 2 years, and she was totally dedicated, very hardworking, and committed to the children. But there are children in the class these days that are have so many problems, that they're so disruptive, and they should be, like, in smaller classes. But when she tried to push for get help to have those children tested and get help for them, she was literally driven out of the profession by principals and administrators that did not want anything changed. And the teacher who took her place when she left, a student literally hung on that teacher's hair.
Dana?
Yeah, well, you hear those stories a lot, and certainly children with special needs do benefit from smaller classes. That's totally well-known and uncontroversial, and sometimes they don't get what they need in a situation of scarce resources. I think it's important to realize that there's nothing new about there being students with special needs in our schools. You know, for my book, I looked at education, you know, in the early 20th century, the early 1900s. And at that time, we had immigrants coming from Italy, from Ireland, from Poland. A lot of them needed a lot of assistance. They were very poor. Their children may not have spoken English. So the kind of challenges we're facing today in our public schools are American challenges. They're not unique to 2015.
We go next to Chet in Maquanico. Hi.
Hello, Joy.
It's Kathleen, but that's all right.
Sorry, Kathleen. Geez, sorry. But no, I'm I feel that no one goes into teaching because they want to make a lot of money. You know, no one says that they want to be a teacher because they want to be a millionaire. And it's a service. It's a human service to humanity. And the biggest part of that is that children are a variable. You can't really have the same machine every day. You don't have the same situation every day. You can't just adjust the widget maker to fix things. You can have one child great one day and not so great the next, and the home environments and the different things that they have to experience, their children. And I just feel that it's so hard to judge a teacher on so many levels, or what the teacher is doing on so many levels, because I've been teaching for 15 years, and I could swear they had the four timetables down last 3-4 months ago, and all of a sudden now I can't remember them, you know? It's one of those variables, and I just think it's an honor. It's a sacred profession, teaching, and when I die, I'm going to ask myself, what did I do for children? And that's all it's really going to matter to me, to my epitaph.
Dana.
Well, that's very touching. I love those sentiments. It is more difficult to judge or evaluate teaching than it is to judge or evaluate other professions. There's really no doubt about that. And I write a little bit in my book about how for 200 years we've tried to come up with some sort of formula or math problem that can solve this challenge of how teachers are doing and, help us distinguish the best teachers from the worst teachers. And it's really hard to do it in such a mechanistic way. I think what we can do is we can, go into teachers' classrooms and we can watch what they're doing and we can see how they're doing. But it's really important that when that happens, those classroom observations are done by somebody who actually understands what it is to teach, by fellow teachers. And too often, that's not the case.
Thank you very much. He is, and it's true, because we can all remember teachers who really had it as a mission, who had it as a calling to be a teacher, because for many years, teachers have not been paid. They're not at the top of the pay scale, that's for sure. And they're in their work as people choose certain professions to make a difference.
Yeah, that's true. And not only that, but teachers who feel mission-driven to do the job, as the caller clearly is, those teachers have better outcomes with kids, and there's some really fascinating research that shows that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Chet. Saeed in Green Bay. Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I believe your statistics that there's a teacher shortage, but you wouldn't be able to tell that by the experience that my daughter had in trying to get a teaching position. And if you're talking about a mission-driven individual, my daughter has graduated in the top 5% of her class from Stanford, has two master's degrees from Columbia, and she had to actually take a job for a year as a teacher's assistant to get into the system, to play by the rules of a system that is not a meritocracy, but a bureaucracy that is incredible. It is incredibly difficult for talented young blood to come in. It is controlled by union rules that resist reform. You are totally right. We have to absolutely invest in education, but I don't mind paying for education, but I mind paying for reform-proof failure factories. Some of the reforms that have taken place in our state are aimed at addressing that, not at reducing how much we invest in education. We must invest in education, but we have to reform the system so that our investment is a good investment. Investment can produce the results.
Where was she trying to teach, Saeed, and did she find a job?
She actually looked in Green Bay, but she eventually got a job in Minneapolis.
Uh-huh.
But her journey started actually when she did her student teaching in New York, and she wanted to work in in at-risk areas. She wanted to actually work in Harlem. And the city of New York had a freeze on education. She waited that out for 2 years, was unable to get a job. At the time that she couldn't get a job, the city of New York was spending $100 million a year on paying teachers in the rubber rooms. These are teachers that the state deems too unqualified or too essentially incompetent to put them in the classroom, but they can't fire them. Because the arbitration boards are controlled by the unions. This is what drives the taxpayers crazy.
Dana.
Yeah, I mean, what Saeed is saying are, common arguments that you hear when you're discussing teaching in America. The rubber room that he mentioned, I think it's important to realize that that's 0.1% of the 80,000 teachers in New York City, which is where I live, so I'm very familiar with the system here, and a lot of those policies have been reformed over the past several years. You know, it hasn't always been a profession that is the most welcoming to young people trying to enter it. At the same time, the first few years of a teaching career are very difficult, and we know about a third of teachers are leaving within the first 5 years. Those who leave tend to be less skilled than those who stay, so there's this sort of falling off effect. It's very important that we do more, not just in terms of how we pay teachers or how we recruit them, but that we support them And teachers do need a lot of support in the first several years on the job. And it's not always a bad thing for a new teacher to be sort of an apprentice in those first several years so they can learn from a mentor.
And before we speak with the president of the American Federation of Teachers, I know that you have in your book talked about outdated union protections, citing the last teacher hired to be the first fired during layoffs. Saeed is concerned about the unions. Do you have other concerns about unions carrying on with practices that are not beneficial?
Well, the policy you mentioned, LIFO, or last in, first out, is one that I don't think makes a lot of sense. That's a policy in which, when there are budget cuts, the least experienced teachers are let go first, regardless of competence. I think seniority should be a tiebreaker in those situations. I don't think seniority should be the only factor. Most states don't have a law like that on the books. It's a minority of states that do. But yes, I did say in my book that that's something that should be changed. If you're talking about the issue of teacher tenure, which I know has been so controversial in Wisconsin mm-hmm. and across the country, I think it's important to realize where tenure comes from historically. You know, teaching is a very politicized job. Parents influence the classroom very much. Politicians influence the classroom very much. And in order to give teachers the ability to speak out on education policies that they may disagree with, tenure evolved as a very important protection. And it started around 1907. And at the time, it was something that reformers and teachers agreed upon. It was not controversial. It's become controversial as fewer and fewer other Americans are unionized and fewer other Americans have job security. But I always try to put it in historical perspective.
Mm-hmm. We are introducing now Randy Weingarten to the program, and Randy is the president of the million member American Federation of Teachers. They represent teachers, paraprofessionals, and school-related personnel, higher education faculty and staff, nurses, and other healthcare professionals. She served for 12 years earlier as president of the United Federation of Teachers, Local 2. Representing educators in the New York City public school system. She's launched major efforts to place education reform high on the nation's agenda, and she is with us. We mentioned that New York Times piece on the teacher shortage in the country, which drew attention to all states looking at whether or not they had shortages, and it turns out in Wisconsin there is a shortage right now, and the real drop-off of the number of people who are studying to become teachers in colleges and universities all over the country. Randy, thank you very much for joining us with this conversation today. Hi.
And, you know, I was I'm always happy to hear Dana. And but I did hear Saeed's question, and as one of the people, myself and my successor actually have negotiated several contractual terms to get rid of the rubber rooms and to make sure that these cases are done within 2 to 3 months. And so, you know, that has actually been accomplished. The cases in New York City take on average less than 100 days now. Mm. And so, you know, but, you know, that's the problem solving that you do. And frankly, what we did was we actually dealt with the issue of making sure that newer teachers were not accessed out of schools when you had these huge budget cuts, and so that was part of what happened in New York City, that there was a lot of people who were in, you know, schools that were closed who were great teachers that we had to actually place. But instead of bumping everybody around, the contract that we did in 2005 basically said, you know, if you've been hired for the school and there's a really good fit, you're not going to be moved around a lot. And so, you know, myths die hard. But I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you heard that. And Saeed, thanks for the call. From reading these stories about the number of young people going into education and how schools are seeing drop-offs of 50% from the past few years, the number of states that have severe teacher shortages, looking at all the controversy in the state of Wisconsin, which you're well aware of, Randy, I'm beginning to think that we could very soon be facing a really bad situation when it comes to public schools in this country for staffing. Do you think so?
Absolutely. I mean, and you know, Dana is right. We don't know if it's simply about standardized tests or other reasons. But there's both the, but just take a, close your eyes and take a common sense approach to this. Think about it. In the last several years, because of the recession, there's 300,000 fewer teaching positions in the United States.
Goodness.
And so, and so when people, and then people say, okay, you know, teachers are not being hired. So why would they go to teacher institutions on a macroeconomic basis? But then on top of that, what has happened is that there's been wage stagnation. There's been all these wars, you know, whether or not you agree or disagree, and I totally disagree with what Scott Walker did, but whether you agree or disagree, the fact that teachers and their voices have become pinatas, why would somebody want to go into teaching? At the very same time as half of the kids in the United States in public schools are poor, at the very same time as we are asking teachers to do more and more and more. So you have a combination of factors that are big neon signs that say, why would somebody want to go into this where they have no latitude, they have no voice, they have no protections other than people saying, trust us, at the very same time as they're saying, I'm going to cut schools and I'm not going to give you independence or voice.
Yeah. And when you described in your letter to the editor in the New York Times, we've always asked teachers to be a combination of Albert Einstein, Mother Teresa, mom and dad, and now we're judging them, and we do expect them to be that, and many of them are, you know, variations on that combination. But now it's, how are your students doing when they take the test in English and the one in math?
So, and frankly, you know, what's happening across the country is that people are saying, and, you know, and I think you're starting to see this in the new surveys that are coming out this year, and you saw it in terms of what just happened in the Congress, that both the House of Representatives and the Senate took on high-stakes testing and said, we need to rebalance this. It's just that it doesn't make sense that a student who's about a lot of things would basically be judged on one day a math test a year and one day an English test a year, and that her teacher would be judged by that and that her school would be judged by that. Now, let me say really quickly, we have to find meaningful ways of judging teachers, and we have to find meaningful ways of judging student achievement. But what we've learned in the last few years is high-stakes testing over these two subjects aren't it. And it's time to go back to the drawing board, like we did, you know, in the mid-30s and 40s and 50s and 60s. But we need to actually do this work together and learn from the places that do it well. And you start with really valuing teachers. There's a little ditty, which is like, you know, we're asking teachers to do all these things, and yet we don't want them to be heard. We want them to be seen and not heard. But they're the ones, they and parents are the ones that are closest to our kids. So we need to kind of shift this and trust the people who are in schools. The best thing that I've seen in the last few months is that there was a survey done online by about 30,000 teachers who talked about all these stresses and strains, and yet 85% of them said they would stay as teachers for the same reasons as the people who called in. People love to make a difference in the lives of kids.
Right.
Let's let them.
Right.
That's the bottom line. Let's let them.
Yeah. I just came from last weekend a very significant high school reunion, and it was an extraordinary weekend. But I cannot tell you, people came from all over the country. I went to school in the Chicago suburbs. How many people remembered a specific high school teacher, and it completely changed his or her life, so these people became what they became, and they were good people, hardworking people at the top of many very accomplished professions, and it was because of a teacher. We all had those stories, and it changed our whole lifetime, you know?
And frankly, you know, if somebody shouldn't be teaching, we should have fair and reasonable teacher evaluation programs, and there are places that have done it, and we have to go back to the drawing board to make that happen. But everybody remembers.
Yes.
The one person that just got to them. And
yep.
Frankly, I remember those kids, and I remember my mom was a teacher mayor, you know, she's deceased now, but the people with whom I grew up still come up to me and say, I remember what your mother did for me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what sparks us as teachers. And essentially what the unions do is we just make sure that they have the tools and the conditions that they need. We are essentially their voice because most of the time none of us have individual power. I wish we did, but we're not Donald Trump. And we don't have gazillions of dollars. And so we have, you know, we champion these things through our unions. At the same time, if there are rules that have to change, we have to have the flexibility to change them. We're in the 21st century. But you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And fortunately, in the last decade or so, that's what's been happening. Testing has substituted for teaching and learning. And it has really sucked out not just the joy, as important as that is, but it sucks out the creativity because essentially it has done exactly what its purpose is. Everybody is focused on the math and the English test to the exclusion of all else.
Yeah. We're going to welcome more phone calls, and we're inviting you to join us at 800-486-8655. Randy Weingarten is with us. Dana is also with us, too. She's listening in, but she can also address whatever you're calling in on. Dana Goldstein, author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Battled Profession, is also with us. Here is how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. We're talking about the teacher shortage, the national teacher shortage in the country this hour of the program with our guests. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Randy, and Dana is with us as well, and we go to Fred in Ashland. Hi, Fred.
Hi. I'm in my 60s. I had parents that were World War II generation. They didn't sit there and really argue or carp or complain to expand the amenities within the physical plant structure. Swimming pools, athletic programs, new schools. And I find it ironic that people my generation and a lot of other empty nesters are carping and complaining about paying for their property taxes and there being a large percentage of it going to school. I find that very ironic. And also, regards to these voucher schools, What if they gave tax breaks to all the public school parents and then see how long the voucher program would last? Then I'll hang up and listen.
All right, Fred, thanks very much for the call. Randy, you want to comment on the voucher schools?
So, look, there's not much support in the United States for vouchers anymore. There's some, you know, and some of it starts from parents who wanted to send kids to parochial schools, and you know, some states allow and some states don't. I think the real issue is twofold. Number one, that if you had all the money in the world and you could actually address the first obligation, which is how we ensure that every neighborhood public school is up to snuff, then you know, then there'd be a conversation about vouchers. But you can't pit private schooling versus what the public responsibility is, which is public schooling.
Mm-hmm.
But the second piece is this. There's been in Milwaukee, in Cleveland, and Washington lots of years with voucher schooling, and it hasn't worked. So none of the promises that were made that the schools would be better and on and on and on happened, and in fact, there's a lot less accountability.
Mm-hmm. Dana, you want to talk about voucher school expansion? It's big in Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, there's been a bit of a revival in places like Florida, Wisconsin, the past several years of talk about vouchers. And if you watched the GOP presidential candidate discussing education yesterday in New Hampshire, you heard vouchers again and again and again and again. So I think it will continue to come up as we move into the 2016 election.
Mm-hmm. Fred, thanks for the call. Boyd in Wautoma, hi.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello to your guests. I wanted to also comment about the whole voucher school system. I find it very alarming that there still is a following for it. And what a lot of people don't know is with voucher schools, you know, in the grand scheme of things, they are still private institutions. And yes, they're certainly willing to take the taxpayer money, but as private institutions, even if a student has a voucher, the private school by no means is obligated to take them, and they can send them away. And their argument for that is well, we're a private institution, so they're not beholden to the same standards that public schools are. And one other thing, and I'll make this brief, if one of your guests know, I believe last year Luther Olson had actually called that if voucher schools were to get public funding, he wanted to have them monitored the same way public schools were. And head of the voucher school system in Wisconsin was very upset with him for that. I don't know if there's any truth to that or not, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Boyd, for the call. Randy, would you like to respond?
So I don't know what Representative Olson did or didn't do, but ultimately what we've seen is that in several systems, the privatized school system wants the public money. We see this in for-profit colleges too, but they don't want to. They don't want the accountability, and they don't want the transparency. And at the end of the day, we have a public responsibility to all our students to give them a high-quality public education. Parents make a choice to do something else; that's their choice. But our obligation is for all students. And I think Dan is right. It's going to come up over and over again because what it is a acknowledgement that the Republican candidates do not want to do the investment and do the management that's necessary to actually ensure that all children have a high-quality public education.
Yeah. Well, certainly Scott Walker and Jeb Bush have been heavily invested in vouchers and maybe some of the other candidates as well. But it's striking to me that I don't think you've had wholehearted endorsement of public education from the Democrats either. Do you?
I don't think we've had. I think that this administration, and look, I have a lot of respect for President Obama for lots of different things, but I think Arne Duncan has not had the full-throttle support of public education that the past Democratic presidents have had, and that I think it's been problematic because it's dissonant from where the public is. The public supports public education, even with all of the problems and all of the wars that, Dana so graphically talks about. There's still this notion that a great neighborhood public school should be a real choice. But there are states like Minnesota, for example, Maryland, for example, Massachusetts, for example, where, there is tremendous support for public education. In New York, the state I come from, there was a huge fight this year with the Democratic governor about the sanctity of public education, and his poll results, his poll numbers tumbled because it looked like he was doubling down against it.
Time for one more phone call. Barbara in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling to make a comment about how people don't want to be teachers anymore. My nephew, who's the son of a lifelong teacher, a very good, dedicated teacher who retired early because she was scared after she lost her voice with Scott Walker's changes. She now is out of public schools and teaching in private schools and parochial school. And her son, who was going on in college, going for becoming a teacher, has now switched to business because he's afraid to become a teacher. And I just, when I heard what you said about people not wanting to be teachers because of what's happened, there's an example for you. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Randy.
Look, it saddens I come from a family of teachers, and it is the best job I ever had in my life was to be in front of my high school students at Clark Barton High School in Brooklyn, New York. It's just so, you know, it saddens me, but I think what's happening right now in this, and you're doing it today in terms of public radio, and there's been lots of these discussions since that article showed up in
yes.
the New York Times. We can't give it lip service. This is part of the social compact of the United States of America in our democracy that we say that our kids deserve.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you both. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Dana Goldstein, author of A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Thanks to Scotty Myers for production of this program. And thanks, everybody, for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.